Hey everyone, and welcome to this soapbox edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. If you're looking for the weekly news and current affairs focused show that we do here at Risky.biz, just scroll one podcast back in your podcast feed to find it. Soapbox podcasts are our fully sponsored podcast series that we do here. Vendors give us money, we talk to them, and we make and publish these podcasts. But you know, the secret sauce is, in my opinion at least, they're not boring. And yeah, we've got a great guest today, Zane Lackey of Signal Sciences, who is indeed a deeply knowledgeable fella. He is a co-founder of Signal Sciences, and yeah, that is a company that originally set out to create software that would replace the WAF, or Web Application Firewall. They set out to kill the WAF, but in the end, they actually kind of wound up just engineering a much better version of a WAF, like a next generation WAF, if you will. Now, Zane himself has experience in security consulting. He also has experience working security in-house as a defender. And the whole idea behind Signal Sciences was to make the sort of tooling he wished existed when he had his defender hat on. Signal Sciences started off sponsoring this show when really they were just getting going. But these days, you know, I'd kind of describe them as an established company. They're still growing, but I don't really think you'd call them a startup anymore. You know, maybe you'd call them a mature startup or something like that, maybe. But the point is, you know, a lot of people use their stuff now, and that means that Zane has a lot of insight into what's actually happening out there in the world of web application security. And he spotted some interesting themes. Firstly, as you'll hear, he says that Microsoft's Azure platform is actually really hot right now, and a lot of enterprises are going all in on Azure. And he also had some really interesting stuff to say about how Signal Sciences is tackling web application logic flaws, which isn't something that I thought really there would be many vendor solutions for, but you know, you'll hear him talk about that and it's pretty cool. So there's some really good stuff in this interview, and I do hope you enjoy it. I started off by asking Zane to explain why Azure is becoming so popular, and here's what he had to say.
You know, I think it's kind of two forces there, quite honestly. I think they, of course, have been doing a lot of work on the platform and everything there. But I think for a lot of kind of mainstream enterprise that I've been talking to lately, it took them a while to really get to this, what I would kind of call the second generation of cloud adoption, where for a lot of this mainstream enterprise, there's that first generation where a certain business unit or an acquisition or a few leading teams or something like that, they've kind of gone off and done their own thing in cloud. And then as the enterprise really starts to come around and say, wait a minute, we want to have a real kind of top-down strategy here. Some of the early ones really went all in on AWS because they were very tech forward. What I've seen with some of the mainstream ones, and it's probably two-thirds of the conversations I have now, they've gone the other way, and they've said, okay, even if we've had a few teams start out in AWS, we're making the top-down decision that we're going to be very heavy in Azure.
I mean, look, it makes sense to a degree because Microsoft a long time ago figured out that if you want your platform to dominate, then you look after the developers.
Yeah, and they're very good at selling enterprise.
Yeah. Right?
And I think that this, where this all kind of balances out is that for an enterprise of any size, you're going to end up multi-cloud, whether you want to be or not. And I think that influences a lot of decisions, right? I think what ends up happening is you might have your center of gravity in one, and that's usually where a lot of the real data lives, but you're going to have, you have applications in all of the above for the cloud providers. I'm just seeing that kind of center of gravity decision, and it was really quite interesting. I've been seeing it more and more happen towards Azure.
And why is that? Why is Azure winning over AWS in some of these contests?
Yeah, it's been a little bit different in every company I've talked to, but I'd say the commonality has been a very top-down decision. So I think Microsoft leveraging kind of their enterprise expertise there and their expertise in top down.
I guess too, that giant DoD contract award would probably, you know, it probably helps as well. Cause I mean, if they're getting multi-billion dollar military contracts, I mean, the thinking is, you know, and whether or not this is sensible or not, but the thinking is, well, yeah, this must be a good platform.
Yeah. I think every bit of momentum helps, right?
Yeah.
I think that's true everywhere. But I think you're really going to see with all these.
It's not that it's inherently like got some advantages over AWS. It's just like better marketed.
No, I think it does. I don't think I'm comfortable enough in the nuances of every platform there to call out it's this feature versus that feature. But what I really see is, yep, there's some that seem that tend to play better for certain feature sets, others that play better for other types of applications or services there. Like the perfect example I think of that is actually neither of those two. It's Google, it's GCP, which I consistently almost always see in two cases. Number one, it's a very heavy kind of ML AI application where they're doing TensorFlow and they're doing a lot of work around that. Or the second case, which is their CTO was a former Google employee.
Those
are really the only two cases.
Well, it's funny because you're singing the praises of Microsoft's ability to sell into enterprise. That is not something Google has quite mastered yet, right? I mean, they're famously bad at that. It's interesting too when we're talking about Azure, because I was just telling you this anecdote before we got started. But I got a friend who has an involvement in a fintech startup, and everything like they've done is Azure serverless, right? Like they're pretty forward leaning, and it's going to be a while before we start seeing major enterprise tilt into completely serverless deployments. But they've got a relatively complicated application which is at the core of their business. Which is all serverless, and they are currently like on a bunch of M&A target lists at the moment, and they're doing those calls. And the CTO is very quite smug when he's being asked, well, how are you handling VMs? And he's like, VMs, they're so 5 years ago, sort of thing. Like it is actually possible now to do what you need to do with serverless, right? For things like core apps.
Oh, completely. I mean, you see more and more and more of it. I think it really lends itself very well to, as we talked about a little bit, about scale and performance and everything there. I know from our side, we see more and more of our customer applications start to be on that. It was one of the big reasons we released Cloud WAF earlier this year, of just being able to sit in front of, it doesn't matter what your application architecture is, whether it's serverless in Azure, serverless in GCP, serverless in Amazon, doesn't matter to us.
And it makes sense too. Like what you're saying is like, as people pivot to serverless, you're not going to be running on the sort of web server there, right? You are going to have to be in line. But how does it change the game for a web security company like yourself?
Yeah.
When all of a sudden your customers, you've got customers using serverless. I mean, the techniques people use to attack serverless are very different to how they would attack a traditional web application.
Oh, completely. And this was one of the things that drove me nuts about the legacy web app firewalls was, as in a previous CISO role for me, like we had multiple legacy WAFs. And the huge problem was you kind of lost on both sides. You went through this tremendous amount of political capital to get the thing deployed. And then spend a ton of time tuning and breaking the apps and the APIs with false positives. And eventually you get through all that. And then at the end of the day, what does it actually cover for you? It's like OWASP injection stuff, right? The SQL injection and the cross-site scripting and all of those.
Yeah, real generic stuff, right? Yeah.
Right. And they never were the thing that actually kept me up at night. I think serverless has really kind of really brought that home, which is what I always wanted and what we then were able to kind of build Signal Sciences around was protecting way beyond that. So that the coverage over account takeover and credential stuffing, the coverage over bots, the coverage over API abuse, and specifically on serverless, a lot of times the real focus there is the abuse of the application business logic itself.
Yeah.
Right? It's application abuse rather than a SQL.
But how do you come up with any type of generic protection against like logic flaws, right? Because that's always been something that's been regarded as, well, you wouldn't try that because it's kind of impossible.
Oh, completely. And this is where the vendors always went, I thought, down just the almost comically wrong path, right? Which is they would go and try to wave some marketing AI and ML at it and say, we're going to magically learn everything you do. And then we'll tell you what the problems are. And the reality is that I would have bought that argument if we had stayed in the waterfall world where applications never changed.
Yeah.
But that's
the problem, right? You build up your data set, you build up your corpus of machine learning training data, and then a developer pushes a change and it's no good anymore. Right?
Surprise. Yeah. Right. And go ask anyone, whether it's an enterprise technology person or an enterprise security leader, ask them if their applications are changing more or less now than it was 5 years ago, and you'll get your whole answer why that whole model of, oh, we should be in a learning mode all the time falls out the window.
Can you divine some tells of business logic you know, because that's the thing. I'm guessing that quite often you're not going to be able to come up with a pretty reliable detection against an unknown business logic flaw, but you might be able to come up with a couple of indicators, right? Like a couple of hints. Yeah. You know, what do those hints look like?
Completely. And that's what we did, and what we kind of, what we call templated rules, although I'm clearly not the world's best marketing person, because we should really brand that as something. But it's exactly what you're saying, right? It's more that there are a lot of, there are common tells across the board, but there's also just common functionality. And then how that functionality, that kind of common business logic, how it gets implemented is different for every enterprise. But if you think about it, if you abstract it one layer, you can actually get really broad coverage in a way that you just need to kind of put in the details for each particular one.
So let me guess, because I'm thinking, and I don't know this, but I'm guessing what you've done is you've come up with like templates with state flow for various things, like password reset flow, things like that. And then you can actually teach or show your Signal Sciences deployment, like these are what the steps normally look like, and then raise alerts when things don't go in that sequence. Is that kind of how it works?
That's pretty much spot on, right? Yeah. And then you can also do it across different areas of functionality. So we can say, look, we don't know the details of your particular banking application, but we know that there's going to be, you know, things that make money transfer, there's going to be account creation, there's going to be viewing statements and things like that. So we've templatized all of that, and then we just drop in whatever the particular URL is for that. And
So it's state monitoring.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Your deployment that people expect to be weeks, we actually see production deployments on that in minutes to hours.
You're going to have some interesting issues there, though, because you're going to have someone hitting the back button and then getting a giant Signal Sciences, you know, you've been dropped alert. I mean, has that been an issue when doing that sort of state?
Yeah, you try to get a little bit smarter than that, right? You want to, that's kind of the philosophy. And then as far as the implementation, like you don't want to make a snap judgment on one thing. You want to get a little bit more context as to what's going on. You want to see like a few of these sort of things before you actually make a decision there. And you want to give the big thing really here is you want to give the customer transparency into all of this, right? Think how many times we've all been burned by vendor solutions where it said it blocked something. It turns out it was not an attack. It was just a weird customer. And they can't tell you why they blocked it or what went into anything there. Mm. And the real key here on all of this is you give them a timeline of exactly what happened. You give them the insight into exactly what made up these decisions. And then you give them the control to be able to change that if they want. But the real thing here is, like I said, I think we're all sick of security black boxes that end up breaking our applications and our APIs.
And we're going to get to another topic later on in this interview, which is something that you see on the horizon, which is this fusion between, you know, dev-oriented companies and security-oriented companies. And that's why, right? So, you know, we will get to that. But I do want to keep talking about, like, you know, how do you stay relevant, you know, in a server? And look, it's ridiculous to even be talking about this, but like, that's what we do on the show is we talk about like the security of 15 years from now, right? Like not necessarily now, because there, you know, serverless is like 0.01% of the market, but we're always focused on the next thing. So I'm guessing, you know, that's going to come back down to things like that, right? So being able to keep an eye on state in an application so that you've got at least some idea of when things are going off the rails or someone's found a business logic bug. You're going to be doing stuff like keeping an eye out for CRED stuffing, you know, bots, stuff like that. I mean, that's essentially where you're going with this, right? Like that's where you still provide value.
Yep. And that's where we, you know, your joke earlier that was spot on, which is like, we got so fed up with WAF that we went out and kind of invented around in a circle to an actually good WAF. That's the big part of it, is moving beyond that kind of classic OWASP injection stuff. It's covering the different ways in which people actually attack APIs and applications now, whether that's business logic or ATO or bots or any of these different pieces.
One thing we did just touch on there, and you know, we'll get to that now, is this idea that companies that make developer tools and companies that make security tools are naturally going to get closer together. I believe you've got a partnership in the works with a sort of DevOps focused, you know, developer tools company. Tell us what you can about that. But I, you know, the reason I find this interesting is like when you start adding security functionality. You know what I can't wait for is for someone to actually release like kind of like an SDK, like a security SDK for web apps. I'm sure people have done, you know, there are products out there. I don't know. I don't hear about them. I'm sure they're out there. But yeah, tell us about what this integration is going to look like between you and this company and like where you find you can most sensibly collaborate from day one.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, RIP to your inbox there. I'm sure 50,000 vendors are emailing you the moment this airs.
We've got a security SDK for web apps. Here it is, you know? Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. RIP. No, I think that, you know, I'm sure I'm supposed to be a good vendor here and pitch some upcoming partnership that we're doing, but the honest truth is, I think what's more interesting here than kind of the given partnership that we're doing and going to be announcing in a little bit here is more just the broader shift that this means for the security industry, which is a lot like you said, that security companies have historically partnered with security companies for the most part.
Yeah.
And I think that convergence of the security, the user of security technology no longer just being in the security department. So it being the DevOps team, the application teams, the delivery teams, all of these different ones having a real use for security technology. I think that means that this is really converging over time and that we're going to see more and more of the more modern security companies partner with the more modern DevOps sort of companies.
But where does that make sense? Like, so that's kind of why I was getting at this whole idea of like an SDK. Like, where does it make sense for you to be in the development cycle, right? Because at the moment, it's like, yeah, you drop your cloud WAF in front of your application and that's that. So where does it make sense to actually bring Signal Sciences into that, you know, development process?
Yeah, I mean, it historically was that, right? That was the thing with WAF is I could never give any of my developers access to it, let alone even half my security team. And I think that was a huge challenge. I think the right way to be doing this is to be able to have technologies where the application teams and the development teams and DevOps teams, they can self-serve and consume that security visibility. And then you bring it back and tie it in with the rest of that tool chain. So that's kind of the broad answer. I think the specific answer there is, you know, what makes sense there? Well, it's the DevOps tools that are already living in production, giving developers access to the overall kind of health of their services and their applications.
So you can give sort of visibility and monitoring to a specific part of an application to a specific team. That's kind of what you're getting at, right?
When you're an application team using that and you see suddenly the performance of a certain service blow out, usually your first question is, oh, is it being attacked? Yeah. That's kind of just web operations 101.
It's amazing how people want their security technology just to tell them specifically what an attack is, when really, you know, you can infer so much just from some sensible graphing, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then be able to combine those up, right? What you really want is the context so that the dream here is that there is enough context that an application team, a DevOps team, or a security team could look at that visibility and instantly be able to discern, is something happening in production, an attack, a abuse of some business logic or a service, or a just performance issue because of a bad code deploy or anything there. I think the reality in almost every organization today is that each group only has their own siloed bit of data. And this is what we actually see inside our customers is usually one of those groups will bring us in and then give access to the other two groups. And then those groups end up making a big use of our platform as well because they're able to get that context.
How does the self-provisioning work though? Like, that's the bit that I'm curious about. Are you talking about this when it's being used as an inline WAF? Are you talking about it when it's running on the actual web servers? Like, how does that work?
The whole platform on our side is all both API driven on the back end. So you can do it's all API first. So you can interact completely with the API. And then the way that you deploy, it all feeds in the same back end and it's all built for automation. So you might have one group where it's rolled into Chef or Puppet or Ansible and just automated deployed that way. In other words, just baked into the container. Another who uses us as the cloud WAF bit and fronting serverless apps. And that all rolls in the same spot. So then they can interact with that all in the same way. This is actually huge for folks outside the WAF industry who've only worked with one or two of them. This is actually a really big change because historically, with all the different legacy WAF providers, everything that they offered was a completely siloed product. So you might have one physical appliance in a data center somewhere, and then a CDN style deployment somewhere else. And you had two completely separate management and control planes, and there was no convergence at all. In ours, it's all the same SaaS backend. So it's all scalable there. And you can interact with it the same regardless of the deployment option, which seems completely straightforward. And yet was not the case for any of the legacy folks.
Yeah. Yeah. So just to remind listeners, I mean, you know, you do have an inline cloud WAF, right? You do have software that runs on a web server. And is there another way to deploy it?
There's actually a few brand new ones that we just released. So there's many different ways to deploy. The nice bit is we give this whole menu to our customers so that they can choose. They can do, for one app, they might do the cloud WAF style deployment, which is just the DNS change, and you put us in front of anything you want.
Yeah.
For another, it would be to drop an agent in with the web server. For another, it would be for that same agent to run with a command line flag and function as a reverse proxy, maybe for legacy apps or anything like that. For another, it would be to bake into the container or to tie into the application. And then the two really new ones are, we release support for Envoy and for Istio. So for really new kind of modern applications and APIs and microservices and everything there, you can just bake us into that same infrastructure that the technology teams are using. And it just auto scales, it rolls with everything completely out of the gate there.
Yeah. You got a few ways there. Yeah, you got a few ways.
More when people ask us, the answer that we're very thankful to be able to give is, hey, what would you prefer? Because we've got it. Whatever style you need, like you don't have to go through that political capital to force only one deployment style.
When is Signal Sciences going to offer like a development library, right? Where you've got functions. What's that?
Yeah, that's well. You can shim into the application.
Oh, you can do that already, right? But I mean, you know, how involved does the developer need to be in like invoking that functionality? Are there like specific functions that you add to your actual application?
No, you don't need to go hook everything like that. It's more, think of it more as kind of inserting a library right at the top.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you don't have to go rewrite the app.
I think I remember that in that library. Like, so where does that output go? That just goes and connects to the API, does it?
Yeah, connects to the agent, which connects to the API.
Yeah,
exactly.
No, it's
and
pretty
so it's
cool.
Uniform across all of this.
But this is the funny thing. Let me guess, right? Like, not many people are using it that way. They're usually just dropping you in line. They're doing it the dumb way.
Completely.
Yeah.
We've seen probably every deployment pattern you could imagine.
Yeah, but I'm guessing it's seldom the ones that you think are best that are the most inconvenient that are the ones that people actually use, right?
It's actually an interesting point that's worth talking about for a second, because the real goal of all of these different deployment options is not technical, it's political.
Yes.
It's so that for you as a security leader or you as a technology team, when you're bringing in a new technology, the challenges you're up against, it's not tech, those are the easy ones. The challenges you're up against are political inside the business.
Yeah, it's like going to the network team to ask for a span port. You know, oh, you want a span port, do you, buddy? All right, okay.
Yep.
You know, and the political war begins, right? Or you want some rack space, or you want another agent on the desktop, or you want this, or you want that. So I guess, you know, what you're saying is, you know, that flexibility in deployment is less about getting a better result between one or the other and more about just making sure that you can get around the organizational politics and actually get a sale in there.
Yeah. And I mean, for our, you know, for the champion, whoever is bringing us in, the security team or technology team, it's so that they don't even have to spend that political capital.
Right? Yeah.
We're all used to having to spend so much political capital to bring in a security technology. That's such a breath of fresh air to be able to say, hey, I'm going to bring this to these applications or APIs I want to cover, but I don't have to jam one architecture down their throat. I can give them a menu and they can choose whatever one they want.
You know, this is why Haroon Mia made Thinx Canary a tiny little hardware device. Right? People are like, why isn't it in a rack mountable box? And he's like, so you don't have to ask for the rack space. So you can literally like sneak into the data center and deploy it.
It's why Haroon's one of the smartest people in security.
But it's funny. I just thought that was an interesting approach where you're essentially creating a product that allows your users to violate company policy connecting, you know, just throw it in under your desk. That's fine. It's still doing its job.
I mean, that lesson learned going from, I was really fortunate early in my career to be able to go from offense to defense. And the things that you think are very easy for defenders to do from the offense side, not even remotely true.
Yeah.
Right. And it's, you learn kind of what actually impacts enterprise security programs inside there. And a lot of that is just the political challenges involved rather than the technical ones.
Now, look, what is actually happening out there among the customer base? I mean, last time we spoke, it was very much, you know, CRED stuffing is the big thing sort of affecting web app teams at the moment. It's a lot of CRED stuffing and account takeover. I'm guessing that isn't something that's changed in the last year or so, right? It's just accelerated.
It's only increased, right? And I think this is kind of the real shift in risk that's going on from a high level, like taking Signal Sciences hat off completely and just kind of CISO hat back on. this whole shift, and you've heard everyone say this, but it's worth focusing in on, this whole shift from kind of network security to application security, and recognizing that that's where risk has really moved much faster and much more significantly than many enterprises realize. That is what's driving kind of all of that, right? There's always the classic Verizon DBIR report every year, and it's been web app breaches have been number one for what, 9 years now.
It's
insane. Like, you look at that graph and it's almost an order of magnitude more than everything else, in an area where historically we've been less focused as a security industry. And by security industry, I don't mean products. I mean more security teams, right? Yeah. Because the web app or the marketing site, and I'm air quoting for everybody right now, was always one of the least sources of risk, right? It was, okay, well,
that changed. You know when that changed? It was LulzSec.
Yeah.
It was LulzSec. Yeah. Like, people forget that before LulzSec came along and just, did the headline dance by just owning all of these, fairly prominent online properties. Before they did that, like, the fact that web app security could even be a problem wasn't really that well understood. I mean, they made people rich because all of a sudden AppSec, within 6 months of all of that happening, became, it literally became the bread and butter for most security consulting firms. I think LulzSec really were the group that actually fired the starter's pistol on the explosive growth we've seen in InfoSec. If I had to trace it back to one thing, it was them.
Yeah, I think for the application side, absolutely. Because you look at the high profile stuff before that, and it was all the completely hilarious defacements of the late 90s and early 2000s, right? That was a defacement of a marketing site rather than a, here's all of your customer data. Yeah, so I mean, like you said, it's crib stuffing, it's bots, it's API abuse, application logic abuse. It's all of these different things of, kind of like the early days of network security, where it was initially just a straight up stack buffer overflow. And then it went on to, integer overflows and underflows and, all sorts of different attacks and everything from there. Kind of, I think AppSec has hit that same level of, we were all used to kind of one or two attack classes historically. And that because all the data lives at the app now, those number of attack classes have just exploded.
Yeah.
And so you have not just folks trying to compromise the application, but abuse the application or misuse the application in some way. And by application, I mean a classic web app or a whole group of very modern microservicey sort of APIs. It's all kind of one and the same at this point.
I guess one of the reasons earlier that I was speaking about, serverless and Azure and this and that, is it seems to me that, like, no matter what problems we solve in security, say we come up with a method to do really perfect authorization and authentication inside an enterprise, and we've got lockdown hosts with really low attack surfaces, things like Chromebooks or whatever, but even more secure, and say we solve that problem, right? The fact that web applications are becoming this default way for mega corporations to interact with their actual customers, to me, this just means that AppSec has got to be the most secure place to be working in InfoSec if you want to have a 30-year career. And the reason I was just thinking about this recently, because a friend of mine who lives locally actually just brought around this kid. Like, so he used to be this kid's kung fu teacher, right? And the kid's now 18. He's going to university in Sydney to study cybersecurity. And he's like, where should you specialize if you want to be concerned with, job security? And I'm like, that's a good question. And probably web apps. I mean, it feels like that, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of the extension of a bunch of things that we touched on earlier, which is the extension of serverless or even earlier containerization and things like that. If you kind of logically draw that out, it's the abstracting of infrastructure and a lot of the areas where so many of us started out in security, right? When you talked about, I was on a security team, you were probably dealing with firewalls and IDSs and, AV and stuff on the endpoint side. But a lot of that core bit, as that starts to abstract away, what is left and what is the main focal point for both attacks and for the actual data, it's the application layer. It's the APIs that power everything. It's the applications that kind of consume those APIs and everything there. And I think it's a very strong focal point for folks getting into the industry that to focus on that. And it's a nice blend of, spend some time learning on the programming and application development side, and then blend in the security bit. I mean, I think one of the greatest hires I've made on security teams in the past were hiring developers inside the organization to come over to the security team.
Yeah.
Because they really understood the architecture and the APIs and everything there.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to chat to you. I always enjoy these chats. Of course, people can check out Signal Sciences at signalsciences.com if you're looking for some, you know, security tooling to look after your web apps. Very informative chat. Good pitching too, by the way. great to chat to you, man. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Likewise, man. Absolute pleasure as always.
That was Zane Lackey of Signal Sciences there. Big thanks to him for that. And huge thanks to Signal Sciences for being such a great sponsor over the years. You can check them out at signalsciences.com. And that is it from me this week. I'll be back next week with another news and current affairs edition of the show. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.